Good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's internet seminar using GIS tools to analyze, compute, and predict pollution. This session is the third one and we're going to be focusing on community engagement. And what we're going to do is talk about how GIS approaches and tools can be used in reaching out to communities. So we're glad you're here. This session is sponsored by the NIEHS, the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. And I'm a Health Science Administrator with the Superfund Research Program. Again, my name is Heather Henry, and I'll be moderating today's session. So hopefully everybody had no trouble getting on and logging on, but I will be covering a few housekeeping items to allow those of you who are still in the process of logging on to get settled and into the webinar format. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. So you should be seeing the front page of the webcast, and that contains a short abstract of today's session. We also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. So please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on this page in case you have any questions for one of them today or after the session today. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone has been placed on mute when you join the call. So we request that you leave your phone on mute for the seminar. But you will have you will have time during our allotted question and answer session where you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask questions. And you might want to jot this down if you are calling on the line. When we get to a question and answer period, in order to unmute your line, you'll hit *6. And then after asking your question, you can hit *6 again, and that will put your phone back on mute. So again, *6 is the formula for getting on and off mute. So anyway, this mute function really allows us to cut down on the background noise, which as you can imagine with all the people who have called in, it really helps us keep the quality of the audio much better by doing it this way. We also ask that you do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements, and that can be very disruptive to the call. So again, please keep us on mute, and please do not put us on hold. I'm not hearing any elevator music, so I think we're doing pretty good today so far. So by now, you should have clicked on the GoTo session icon, and you should be joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room. You should also see a number of windows or pods within the room, which includes the presentation materials. So slide number one of the presentation should be visible, and you'll see the title and the clue-in, cleanup information logos on the top. So using this webinar tool, Adobe Connect participants can view the materials in real time as our presenters provide the seminar. So what that means is that you're not required to advance manually through the slides. You just get to sit back and relax and watch the presentation being conducted by our expert presenters. If you do, however, have problems viewing the slides or the shared content, you may click on the full screen button in the upper right corner of the shared slide window, and that will expand the content. To shrink it back down to normal size, simply press full screen again. So y'all can toggle with that if you like. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. Please note that we cannot confirm that all portions of a seminar will be available in this manner. I do believe on one of the earlier connecting screens there was an opportunity to download the PDF version of the slide. So if you are experiencing that difficulty, that should be an option for you today for the webinar. But hopefully you are looking at the clue-in front page of our webinar, and as our speakers talk, they will advance the slides. So a majority of the participants will be listening to the audio online through Adobe Connect. So please be sure that the speaker icon appears bright green. If not, please click it to enable online audio through Adobe Connect. That's very important. You want to be able to hear through the computer. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phone, you may need to turn off your speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. So you may submit questions by using the Q&A pod that you see on the lower right corner. You do not have to wait until the Q&A period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit your questions in advance of the Q&A session, which we'll do after each speaker finishes. Please note that the questions will only be visible to the host, so that's us. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. So at the appropriate time for Q&A, I will read your questions out loud to the presenters. So again, please look for that Q&A, and whenever you have a question, you can ask. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us of the technical difficulties you are encountering. And I think some people have been doing that and letting us know and have been responded to. And there were some comments about barely being able to hear, but I'm not sure if that's still an issue. Maybe, Jean, you can jump in and let us know if that's the case. But I see that many of you are using the Q&A to alert us of questions, and that's exactly what you should be doing. That's wonderful. If you are really having issues, then you can include a telephone phone number where you can be reached, and we can try to help you troubleshoot your problem. So again, if you are having real issues, you can add your telephone number to the Q&A, and you will get called by the technical support. Also, if you have that piece of paper handy, you can jot down the technical support phone number, which is 301-589-5318. Again, 301-589-5318. So at the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links to additional resources page where we have assembled additional information that is directly applicable to today's topic. So this will stay on the seminar indefinitely so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive within the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. So associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback because we certainly look at your comments and we use your comments to continue to improve the content and delivery of our webinars. So you can also request a confirmational email from feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Do not put us on hold. So today's presenters are Andrew Larkin from Oregon State University and Dr. Lex Van Heen from Columbia University. And before we move on, I do want to thank Jean Ballant and her folks at CLUIN, as well as Justin Crane from MDB Associates for all of their help in putting together the webinar. And again, so I'll go ahead and introduce our first Superfund Research Program webinar speaker for today. This is Dr. Andy Larkin. And Andy, she's not quite a PhD. Andy is a PhD candidate, and he is a trainee for the Oregon State University Superfund Research Program, and he's in the Department of Toxicology. He received a BS in chemistry and a postdoc in bioresource research at OSU, and then got an MS in forensic toxicology at the University of Florida. His primary mentors are David E. Williams and William M. Baird. And Andrew's PhD research is focused on developing methods and technologies for bridging the gap between toxicology studies and personal risk assessment. His additional research projects include award-winning fuzzy neural network for predicting changes in gene regulatory networks after exposure to pH mixtures. So Andy, I will now turn the time over to you.
Thank you, Heather. I'd also like to thank Justin Crane as well. He's been outstanding in providing support for getting this running, as well as the NIHS Superfund program for giving me the opportunity to present my work. Today I'd like to talk about using smartphones to provide personalized information about atmospheric pollutants. Location has been used for a long time by scientists to better understand how the environment can affect our health.
Andy, are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here, but apparently my screen
went. Don't worry. I'm going to fix the slides. Not a problem at all.
Thanks.
No problem.
Thanks.
You're next
going to
come right back up. I do apologize for that background noise. We just have a brief delay while we pull those decks up. Andy, you should have continued control. Oh, here we go. Go ahead and re-elevate your privileges. And as soon as you see those slides pull up, I'm going to click a button here, and you should have the ability again to move through the slides as needed.
Excellent. Thanks for your help.
No problem.
All right. So we were talking about location and how we can use it to get more information about how the environment can affect our health. One of the earliest examples of using location to understand this environment-human health relationship was John Snow, who identified the source of a cholera outbreak in London using location. Location is an old dog we've been using for a long time, but throughout time we've been teaching this old dog new tricks. Methods have been continually refined, and around the turn of the century, it became very popular to gather information about personal location, how individuals move throughout the environment, and how that can further enhance our understanding of the human health environment interaction. Recently, location has learned even a newer trick, and this particular trick is incredibly popular and has incredible potential for gathering even more information about the human-environment interaction. This trick is to simply attach a GPS to a cell phone and then enhance that cell phone with basic computing capabilities. This is essentially a smartphone. Smartphones haven't been around for very long, but they are already incredibly popular. There are more than 1 billion active smartphone users, and almost all these smartphones include GPS chips. And these GPS chips are, throughout time, becoming more and more accurate and becoming more and more refined, requiring less battery power. I'm willing to bet that the majority of you who are listening to this webinar have a smartphone. And that's a pretty safe bet because the majority of U.S. adults have a smartphone. For those of you who have a smartphone, I'm willing to bet that the majority of you have used a location-based service. This is basically a service that provides personalized information based on your location. Examples of such services include maps, such as Google Maps, as well as driving directions, as well as getting weather information. Nowadays, it's very common to not actually have to type into a weather program where your location is. It will just know that automatically. We hypothesized that we could link smartphones through the location services with pollution models, thereby providing personalized predicted pollutant information. We hypothesized that we could do this with multiple pollutants, because when we're breathing in air, we're not breathing in just one pollutant at a time. We also hypothesized that we could do this with multiple locations, because people are mobile. We don't stay in one place. We move throughout the environment. And we also hypothesized that we could do this as we collect data for past, present, and near future pollutant levels. And lastly, we also hypothesized that by collecting data anonymously, we could not only look at individual predicted pollutant levels, but also look at this information at a population level. The atmospheric pollution models that we developed to test our smartphone program are hourly forecasts of fine particulate matter, coarse particulate matter, and ozone for the state of Oregon. These models were created by first gathering measured pollutant concentrations at Oregon Department of Environmental Quality air monitoring stations, and then using a seasonal integrated moving average forecast algorithm to predict what the concentrations are going to be for the upcoming hour at these air monitoring stations. We then used NOAA meteorological measurements and NASA satellite imagery to interpolate between the air monitoring stations using universal kriging to create a forecast for the entire state of Oregon. The method by which we link our smartphones to these environmental models is actually fairly simple. The first step is to get the location as well as the current time from a smartphone and send that information to a cloud storage database. Within this cloud storage database, we're running our environmental models. The environmental models look at the latitude and longitude that were sent from the smartphone and identify what the predicted concentrations are at that particular latitude-longitude coordinate pair. When we were developing our cloud storage database system, we wanted the system to be highly adaptable. That is, we wanted to be able to update model predictions frequently as new measurements became available. And we also wanted to update the system with new models if we found that there are models out there that work better than the models we currently have in place. To make this system dynamic and adaptable, we simply created a pollutant model folder. And within this folder, there is one image, one TIFF file, for each output of our model pollutants. Whenever this TIFF file is updated, you're essentially updating the model predictions. To update to a new model, all that's required is to tell the old model, the outdated model, to stop updating files, to stop overwriting files in the pollutant model folder. And likewise, to tell the new model to start writing folders to the pollutant model folder. In this way, it's incredibly easy to make updates to our model structured database. In fact, it's actually easier than updating a PowerPoint presentation. Once we have our predicted pollutant concentrations at the smartphone latitude and longitude, those values are returned to the smartphone via Wi-Fi or a cellular network. This whole process usually takes, if you're in a location with a good Wi-Fi connection, about 10 to 15 seconds. And if you're in a location with a bad Wi-Fi connection, it can take 30 or 40 seconds. Either way, it's becoming fairly fast and getting close to real time. When values are returned to the smartphone, of course we want them to be displayed in a way that can easily be understood by people who are on the go. Some people may sit down around the couch and look at their smartphone, but oftentimes when people are looking at a smartphone, they're on the go and they want information in a quick, easily understandable manner. We designed our smartphone display using the technology acceptance model. This is a model used by businesses all the time to see if a particular source of information or a particular new technology is likely to be adopted by the target audience. The technology acceptance model says that new technologies and new sources of information are likely to be accepted if they're easy to learn, they are very useful, and they don't require a lot of user effort. With these parameters in mind, we decided to use familiar symbols and software, specifically Google Maps and the EPA Air Quality Index categories. By combining these two together, we essentially created Google Maps, where for each point for which the smartphone has sampled a location since the smartphone program started being used on that particular smartphone, there is a point on the map. All these points are color-coded according to the EPA Air Quality Index categories. This provides an easy to look at and easy to understand visual display. But if someone would like more information about a particular sampling point, it's very easy to click on a point on the Google map, and the appropriate information such as latitude and longitude, sampling time, and predicted concentration pop up. To make this map dynamic, we included multi-core processing, so switching between pollutants is fairly easy. It simply requires clicking on the menu at the bottom of the smartphone screen. And one core will handle updating visual display, while another core will perform the database search. This way, it has a snappy feel that feels very responsive and is a positive experience for the user.
Would you like me to play the videos for you now?
Yeah, that'd be great if you could play the first one. Great timing. I completely forgot about that. So instead of hearing me talk, you can just see it in action. And hopefully that gave you an idea. And feel free to go back. We'll have a link to these videos. But it's very responsive, and again, it's very user-friendly. And the idea is to hide the complex information, but have it easily available if someone would like to dig further into our sampling information.
Would you like to play this video or move back to your slides?
Sure, why don't we play a second video while we're at it? And so participants were also interested in having a time series graph to see how their pollutant concentrations change over time. So we created a time series graph, which again, all the points are tappable to bring up appropriate sampling information. And again, we used multi-core processing and made the graph pannable and zoomable for optimal user positive experience. Thanks for playing those videos. It makes it so much more fun to show off an app when it's actually in motion. So at this point, we were getting a lot of feedback from our participants, as well as from fellow colleagues at conferences. And the greatest comment that we heard from both of these groups were that at this point, the app was doing a great job of raising awareness about local air quality conditions. But it wasn't that great for making informed decisions. The comment I heard over and over was, I see a pollutant level I don't like at my current location. Well, what do I do about that? How can I make a positive, informed decision? So with that in mind, we took a step back and realized that up to now, we had been approaching this app from the perspective of scientists. That is to say, we like to collect data from an experiment and look back after the experiment is completed to look and make inferences about what happened in the past. But people are most often concerned about the present and minimizing risk in the near future. So for the next version of our app, which I sort of call App 2.0, is we focused our efforts on developing tools to help people make informed decisions about the near future. The first tool we developed consists of warning bars. And these warning bars are touch responsive and color-coded according to the EPA Air Quality Index categories. There is one warning bar for each pollutant included in our modeling database. And by adjusting the warning bars, the user essentially creates customized warning levels for when they want to be notified when the predicted pollutant concentrations are at or above the exceeded set warning level. Whenever a location update occurs, the warning level information is also sent to the cloud storage database. And the environmental software looks not only at the predicted pollutant concentrations at the current location, but as well as the surrounding area for up to 10 kilometers. If a warning level is exceeded by anywhere in the surrounding area, a warning message is returned to the smartphone. If the app is currently running, the warning message will look as shown on the right, stating the pollutant which was exceeded, as well as the relative direction. If the app is running in the background, a notification will pop up which is specific to each individual smartphone. But the notification includes the basic information, which includes the pollutant which exceeded its warning level, as well as the relative direction. This is probably a good time to mention that this app can run completely in the background, and that's one of the advantages of using a modeling-based approach. So a user can set this app running and essentially ignore it. The user can talk on their phone or have the phone in their purse or have the phone under their mattress if they like, and the app will continue to run, look at predicted pollutant levels, check for warnings, and collect information without requiring any extra effort from the user. Another feature that people expressed interest in, particularly people with asthma, is the ability to upload data from their smartphone through a computer so that they can perform a more complex analysis. People with asthma in particular wanted to see if they could identify conditions linked to balloon concentrations at sites of asthma attack and see if there are conditions which are more prevalent at those sites compared to everywhere else. We developed the ability to upload data from a smartphone to a PC via Bluetooth. The data on the PC end is stored as a CSV file, so from there it can be exported and loaded into any of the conventional statistical programs, like R or Excel or ArcGIS or your favorite statistical program. We also developed a software package which allows the data to be uploaded from the PC to a personal website. And the website looks like the picture here, which is very similar to the smartphone display. From the personal website, a hyperlink to the website can then be sent to a health professional who can help the user identify these predict balloon concentrations which are prevalent at asthma attack sites. And subsequently, of course, this can be tied back to the warning level system, where the warning levels can be sent to those levels of predicted pollutants which seem to be common with asthma attacks. So in addition to all of the values that are returned to individual smartphones, we're collecting all of the values from all of the participating smartphones anonymously. In this way, we can perform sample population analyses to see if we can identify some trends which are common within the sample population. And of course, if the sample population is representative of your target population, it's possible to make some predictions about what might be happening in the overall population as well. The data that's collected anonymously is stored in an SQL database and of course can be exported to a CSV file. So again, you can use any of your favorite statistical packages. In our case, we developed a customized package in the programming language R, which creates these 3D graphs, as shown on the right. The X and Y axes correspond to longitude and latitude, and the Z axis corresponds to predicted exposure level. The points on the graph have variable radii. The points with larger radii, the larger points, have more smartphones at that location, whereas the tiny little dots on the map essentially only have one or two smartphones at that location. If we look at this graph, some of the points with the highest exposure levels have only one or two smartphones at that location, whereas other points which have a lot of smartphones have lower predicted pollutant concentrations. So how adaptable is this software? If we can only get it to work in Oregon, of course it has limited capability. But this approach can be used for any geographic region. As we mentioned, we designed our database to be highly adaptable. If we had a TIFF image of predicted pollutant concentrations for the entire US, we could have that plugged into our model and running within 5 minutes. It can work for any pollutant model which has a predicted value for a given latitude and longitude coordinate, any pollutants, as long as there's a highly accurate model creating the predictions, as well as any media. So if a group wanted to take this approach to try and convey information about arsenic concentration in groundwater, as long as they had a good model to create predictions, then this approach certainly could be used. The smartphones can send location information at any sampling rate. Currently, we send updates every 30 minutes because we have some older smartphones participating. Some of the original iPhones are in this program as participants. And the GPS chips in these older phones consume more battery, and so we don't want to impact the user capabilities too much, and we limit the sampling rate. On the other hand, some of the newer phones that are participating, such as the Samsung Galaxy S3, can have very fast sampling rates. We were able to get sampling rates as low as 5 minutes per update for the Samsung Galaxy S3, and it had a very minimal impact on the battery life. This approach can also be adapted to any device with an operating system and GPS chip. There is a lot of talk about the upcoming new wave technologies such as Google Glass and smartwatches. and this approach could very easily be adapted to those devices. The greatest limitation is that the values that are returned to the smartphones are only as good as the model from which the predictions are being drawn from. So if you have an accurate model, it's more likely you're going to get accurate predictions of smartphone locations. If you have an inaccurate model, you're not going to get accurate predictions of smartphone locations. Similarly, the temporal and spatial resolution of the predictions are constrained based on what the temporal and spatial resolutions are of the underlying models. This approach is also currently only feasible for outdoor air. The technology is there to make it work for indoor air or an outdoor-indoor hybrid model, but we need to have more measurements of indoor air, and we need to better understand air indoor pollutants and the fate and transport of these pollutants before we can develop more serious refined models. So this is one type of approach for providing personalized information about predicted air quality. But there are some other approaches out there which have complementary strengths and limitations. One such approach is to get the chemical composition of what an individual is being exposed to. PM2.5 consists of 100 different chemicals. It's not just one single compound. An example of this approach is being developed by Kim Anderson and her PhD candidate, Stephen O'Connell, at Oregon State. They've been using wristbands, like many of the common wristbands you see people wearing, and modified them so that organic pollutants will attach to the wristband. And the wristband can then be sent off to a laboratory for a chemical composition analysis. Another approach is to integrate sensors themselves within the smartphone casing. And this will provide actual measurements in real time at smartphone locations. All of these approaches have their own unique strengths and limitations, and it's all coming together in a complementary way. I think it's entirely plausible that within the next decade, we're going to see a scenario where we can get highly accurate chemical composition analyses of exposures in the recent past, real-time measurements of exposures in the present, and we can utilize the modeling capabilities to gather accurate information about what exposure levels are like and make decisions that will minimize risk in the near future. So to conclude, we've linked smartphones with pollutant models to predict pollutant concentrations at smartphone locations. This approach can be adapted to work with any pollutant model, any media, any device with an operating system, and a GPS chip. And the future here is really in collaborations and working together. Right now, there's sort of a competitive nature in this field. And I think the next group that's going to give us the next giant leap forward is going to be a super group, a collaboration group, where several different labs working on complementary technologies work together. With that, I'd like to acknowledge the following four scientists who have been absolutely essential to this project and have been absolutely lovely to work with. All of them are from Oregon State, and I'd like to start with my main professors, Drs. David Williams and William Baird. I'd also like to thank my fellow researchers who I worked closely with, Elizabeth Siddons and Sharon Krieger. And of course, I'd like to thank the Superfund program, not only for funding, but for support of graduate students and innovative ideas. I'd also like to thank the data sources which are necessary for creating the underlying environmental models, NASA, NOAA, and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And of course, thank all of you for your time. I really appreciate your attention. And if there's some time available, I'd be glad to answer any questions. And if you'd ever like to chat, even if it's just casual questions and answers, feel free to send me an email anytime.
Great. Andy, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this presentation, and I know we've gotten a lot of questions online, so we certainly will try to get through those questions. There's time for that now, and then like you mentioned and offered that if anyone does want to contact you later, your contact information is on that very first slide, and it's also associated with the website. So before we do start the next presentation answer the questions, let's go ahead and see if anybody has questions on the phone first. So if you do want to ask a question, what you can do is take your phone off mute by pressing *6. Be sure to state your name and organization and ask your question. And then when you're done, you can remute your phone by pressing *6 again. So let's open the phone lines and see if anybody has a question online that they'd like to ask. Okay.
Muted.
Hi, this is Jean Ballant.
Unmuted.
Hi again, this is Jean Ballant. Just checking to see if anybody can hear me on the line. It looks like we had one of the co-moderators turn on a global mute on the phones. So this applies to Heather as well as Lex and Andrew. You guys will need to hit *6 to unmute your phone so you can continue to speak and answer questions.
Hi, this is Kevin. I unmuted all the lines. Okay. Sorry for the confusion, everybody. Should I go ahead and mute everyone's line again?
Let's just leave it as is, and let's see if anybody, if Heather and everyone is still on us. We can mute if needed if it gets to be a problem later on. So, Heather, are you still with us on the phone? Heather, if you did, you might need to hit *6 on your phone. And while we're waiting to check in with Heather Henry, Andy, if you're on the phones, if you could hit *6 and just confirm that you're with me on the phones.
I think I'm back now. This is Heather.
I hear to hit *6.
Okay, I'll try without hitting *6.
Oh, there you go. You're okay. All right, so Lex is there, Andy's there, Heather's there. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please feel free to carry on with your question session.
Great. Well, why don't I just jump in with one of the online questions that came in. A few people asked, so I will not identify names per se, but Andy, there were some questions about the 6 criteria pollutants, and the AQI ID only are used for the 6 criteria pollutants, and only these have the AQI. What about air toxics? Air toxics do not have AQI, was the question.
That's an excellent question. Certainly, a similar approach could be taken, but of course, a color scheme would have to be developed in order to let users easily and quickly see predictable concentrations on that Google map. So it's entirely possible. We actually have it set up so you can just go in and open up a text file and alter what the colors are for each of the different categories. It would be very easy to develop an entirely new color scheme for different pollutants that aren't in the EPA Air Quality Index categories. But of course, that would require some knowledge and some research to try and identify what those particular cutoff levels are for each category and to try and decide which colors are going to be best.
Great. And another kind of related question was what specific pollutants have been mapped using this technology, and what about extreme heat?
Extreme heat. I don't think we have that much in Oregon. Would it be possible to, I'm not quite sure what that question is there, sorry.
Specific pollutants have been mapped using this technology?
Specifically, we've only looked at fine particulate matter, coarse particulate matter, and ozone.
Okay.
Other groups have used similar approaches where they don't necessarily send data back to the smartphone, but they've collected locations. And then later, not in real time, but afterwards, I've used smartphone locations to look at nitrous oxides. Unfortunately, I don't remember the group that was doing that, but it was another Superfund research project, I believe.
Okay. I'm not familiar with that one either. Okay, so another related along the topic is you must have mentioned someone had developed sensors for smartphones. And mm-hmm. Do you know who that was?
The CitySense group is the one that I was aware of that first developed the technology.
Okay.
But to be honest, I believe there are other groups that are out there, and I've read news updates which describe their technology. But I believe we have, yes, a web link to the CitySense group if someone would like to look up their project in more detail.
Great. Okay. We could probably post that on, is that on your last page, your references?
Correct. It's the hyperlink.
Okay, great. Great. Question came about the apps and Android, iOS, is it available for BlackBerry and Windows phone operating systems?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Currently we have this just running on Android and iPhones.
Okay, great. And there was a few questions about predictions. With your predictions, do you provide confidence limits or standard errors around the estimates?
That's a great question. And that's actually the, I'm wrapping up my PhD research right now, and that's sort of the subject of my last year of research. How do we convey information about the uncertainty in the model predictions, as well as what the spatial and temporal resolutions are of those predictions? And how do we actually convey that information in a way that's easy for people to understand who just don't necessarily have a modeling background? So I'm not quite ready to talk about that yet, but I'd like to invite everyone to come to my poster at SOT, and that's actually going to be the main subject of that presentation.
Yeah, well, so kind of on a related level, about talking about errors, whether meteorological data or dispersion, for example, is also entered into your prediction models.
As far as the uncertainty in our underlying data sets?
It says, are errors from predictions as well as meteorological data for dispersion entered into your models?
So we do have the error values that are published by NOAA and by NASA. And we do have a compound error algorithm, which we take into account. The confidence intervals that we're actually collecting are based on leave one out cross-validation studies, as well as leave 10% out cross-validation studies. So for those values, we don't compound the error further, because it's sort of a statistical approach instead of a deterministic approach.
Gotcha. Okay, let's go to the phone lines again and just see if there are any questions from the phone lines. The way to manage your phone to take yourself off mute is to hit *6. Okay, I'm not... Not as many questions online, but we're getting a lot of, I mean, on the phone lines, but we're getting a lot of questions online. So the averaging time for ozone is 1 hour. How will every 5-minute update work?
That's a good question. And that's, again, another subject that we've been dealing with. Some of these EPA air quality index categories are for 1 hour. Some of them are for 8-hour averages. And how do you present the information in a way that's easy for someone to understand, say, for example, on a 5-minute sampling rate? We certainly don't want people to freak out, and that's been a concern with using a sensor measurement approach about spikes that are just very temporary and which may seem very large if it's over a 1-hour exposure consideration, but really aren't that significant if it's just over, say, a 2 or 3 second exposure. that's again something that's sort of the focus of my last year of research. But I think that's a good, something that's very important to be aware of for the entire sort of community outreach group as a whole, is that these technologies, not only this technology, but other ones, are getting finer and finer temporal resolutions. And we need to find ways to communicate risk in a way that reflects those finer temporal resolutions. And this is something that I think the entire community outreach group as a whole has to tackle, so that like the EPA Air Quality Index categories, we have sort of a universal, widely disseminated approach that we can all use.
And you might have just answered this question, but is there a lag time between the air data collection and the model results and the update frequency for the model results?
That's a good question. So the model results have hour temporal resolutions, and values are posted on the Oregon DEQ website about 15 minutes after they're taken. And it then takes our model about 3 to 5 minutes to crunch through the data. So the values are updated about 20 minutes after the measurements are actually taken. And that's sort of why we went with the forecast algorithm. In this way, we're actually predicting what concentrations are going to look like for the next hour. And that will we found actually sort of reduces the effect of this time lag, but it certainly doesn't eliminate it entirely.
Okay. Another question, could time activity diaries be embedded into the app to record activity in time and place where it happens, especially with prospective cohort of air pollution and health outcomes?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, that could certainly happen. There are already several apps out there which are sort of focused on time diaries, and it would be, I don't want to say easy, but it's certainly technically feasible and not difficult to incorporate those aspects, especially if they've already been developed, into our current app. Or alternatively, to take some of the components we have in our app and to incorporate it into an app that's already sort of focused on time diaries.
Great. Just a few more questions. Does your GIS data account for local changes in pollutant concentrations, including elevated levels of contaminants downwind of freeways? And could the smartphone sensor be used to provide this information and thereby modify statewide level data for risk assessment?
That's a great question. That's where I'd like to see this go in the future.
Cool.
But I think our spatial resolution right now is limited. The finest we've been able to get is 1 kilometer squared resolution. And at that level, it's not really possible to get the fine resolutions of, say, being next to a highway compared to being 100 meters away from a highway. So we hope to get there, and we hope to collaborate with groups like groups at Harvard and Berkeley that have developed land-based modeling approaches, which have gotten finer resolutions down to the nearest 100 meters. But our models aren't quite there yet.
Well, you have a place to go then. Look forward
Absolutely.
To it. And there was one series of questions that kind of a little more background. How many monitoring sites were used in the project? How often were samples collected? And what if the participants were not near a monitoring site? What data is given to them?
That's a good question. So all the data that was collected, the participants were within the state of Oregon. And currently, because our models only cover the state of Oregon, if someone's outside the state of Oregon, it simply returns an NA, or a no value. For participants that are far away from a monitoring site, using universal kriging, there's going to be higher error and uncertainty associated with that position. And of course, the accuracy of the model prediction is going to be less as well. I believe the number of sites that are scattered throughout Oregon are dependent upon the season. In Oregon, we have seasonal fuel burning, and during that time, the Oregon DEQ deploys more air monitors. But I believe it fluctuates. This is only an estimate. This is not actual numbers. But I believe it's between 20 and 30.
Okay. Great.
And for ozone, I should also clarify that ozone monitoring only occurs during the peak ozone season, which is spring through fall. During the winter, ozone is not a major concern in Oregon.
Okay. We have a comment that nighttime ozone layer levels are lower. So I don't think that was a question, but just a comment. So thank you so much, Andy, for a very informative presentation. I want to pass on all the compliments that I saw through the Q&A module. A lot of people said great job and that your talk was very, very interesting. So I applaud you for keeping us entertained about this interesting and exciting technology. Please stick around, Andy, because at the end of the seminar, we'll have a little more time for you to join in along with Lex for any remaining questions that might come up. So we encourage any of you who didn't get a chance to ask your question, you can still submit it through the Q&A, and even if you mean to direct it towards Andy specifically, there will be time at the end for him to answer those questions. So again, thank you so much, Andy, for your excellent work. At this time, I'd like to move on to our second presenter. Our second presenter today is researcher Dr. Lex Van Heen, and I hope I'm saying your name correctly.
That sounds fine.
Sounds how do you say your name?
I say Van Heen. That's pretty close.
Van Heen. Okay. I was a little bit close. I was a little bit not close. it was kind of like a horseshoe. Close, but no cigar. In any case, we're really glad that he is here to give us a talk on his work. He is a geochemist by training and joined Lamont Doherty Earth Research Observatory, excuse me, in 1994 after completing his PhD. And he came from the MIT-WHO Joint Program in Oceanography and postdoctoral fellowships in civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and the Water Resources Division of the USGS. His research interests span the reconstruction of past climate change from ocean sediment cores to the health effects on children of exposure to lead from mine tailings in Peru. He coordinates earth science and mitigation efforts under Columbia's Superfund research program on the health effects and geochemistry of arsenic contained in the U.S. and Bangladesh groundwater. Van Heen has initiated complementary studies of behavioral constraints on arsenic mitigation in Bangladesh and the contamination of groundwater with microbial pathogens. He is a firm believer in the more widespread use of field kits by non-specialists to reduce exposure to environmental toxicants, particularly in developing countries. So he holds a Lamont Research Professor appointment and has published over 100 peer-reviewed papers. So at this point, I would like to pass it off to you, Dr. Van Heen.
Okay, thank you very much for the introduction and good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for this opportunity to tell you a bit about some of the work we do here at Lamont Doherty. Following up on Andy's very interesting presentation, where he showed how a largely centrally produced data set can be distributed at the individual level using smartphones. I guess the direction of the flow of information in my case is a little different for a couple of reasons. I'll be talking, my connection to essentially community level information will be more on generating local data using field kits, as you pointed out. And one difference, perhaps, between the type of pollutants Andy was talking about and what I'll be talking about is that, in his case, it seems the spatial, there's both a spatial and a temporal component that needs to be conveyed. And I think in the two examples that I've chosen, so one of them about arsenic in groundwater and the other one about lead in soil, in that case, I think we can for now assume that the temporal component is non-existent. These levels don't change over time, but you have a tremendous level of spatial variability. And so from the work with through our projects, what I've learned and come to realize that if you have a pollutant, if you have a strong source of a pollutant, it takes a lot of energy to mix it. And so these pollutants are typically still very heterogeneously distributed. there are pros and cons to that. That's one of the ideas I'll try to convey today. One is that, of course, so children in particular could be exposed to very high levels, but it also means that you could avoid some of the worst exposure if you had the information locally available. And so that's why I'm going to focus on field kits. I've structured the talk in three main parts. Four parts. I'll review the health effects of lead and arsenic exposure. I'll actually start with a problem that I haven't worked with quite as much, which is lead in mine tailings in Peru in particular. And I'll talk both about mappings, this is a GIS session after all, and about field kit testing. And I'll follow that same scheme to discuss arsenic in well water of Bangladesh. And this is going to be relevant to South and Southeast Asia more generally, and parts of the U.S., as some of you may well be aware. And then I'll focus in the last part on some ideas we've been trying to develop to not only get the field kits to work, but also have them be used by someone, and that's still a challenge. And I'll be interested to see if some of you listening have some ideas about that. So let's start with a review of health effects. And actually, I need to update my slide. I should have done that before, with respect to the action level recommended by CDC for lead, which is no longer 10 micrograms per deciliter in blood, but has actually been lowered to 5 micrograms per deciliter. Many of you will know that. So both arsenic, the main pathway for intake in South and Southeast Asia is water, drinking untreated groundwater from tube wells, which are inexpensively installed. There's a WHO guideline, which is now also the EPA level of 10 microgram per liter for arsenic in drinking water. In Bangladesh, it is still 50 microgram per liter. Switching over to lead, the EPA, maybe this will have to be revised now with the new CDC action level, has established that 400 ppm is the maximum lead allowed in soil where children play, and 1200 ppm lead for residential areas where children do not play. And down below, I just printed the tops of a couple of papers, one of them on arsenic, illustrating in a rather vivid way the effect of drinking arsenic. Without spending too much time on it, essentially people who were drinking water with more than 150 microgram per liter in our study area as part of a cohort study that were twice as likely to die over a 10-year period that we've been monitoring as people who were drinking water with up to 10 microgram per liter in the water. And the other paper to the right is a startling study by a large group in Nigeria, where the extraction of gold from ore that also contained a lot of lead in a very artisanal fashion was creating horrible problems and killing children. Some of you may have seen that paper. So clearly we have a serious issue. And I'll start with lead. And this slide is the result of a GIS exercise that we came up with not too long ago. And what we started with is listed in the lower right of the slide, is that Peru, it turns out, has a pretty good listing of active mines, the 113. Ore concentration plants, a fairly small number of smelters, but mostly many legacy sites. So mining in Peru has been taking place since pre-Columbian times, and this is probably still an underestimate of the sites that really have been exploited at various times. So what we did is that we combined this information with population and density a map that conveniently made available by the Center for International Earth Science Information Network, which is also based here on the Lamont campus. And we decided, after some close-up studies that I'll show you in the next few slides, we decided that a 5-kilometer radius would be a reasonable estimate to understand, you know, the how far the population living, you know, around these legacy sites or active mines could be affected. And from that, we and so you see these individual sites on the map of Peru. The shading reflects the population density, so clearly higher, the brown colors in some of the major cities, coastal cities in particular, much thinner in other parts. And then you have each of these merged buffers, these circles and various shapes. Those are around the sites, both the active sites and the legacy sites. And the numbers essentially correspond to the top 30 sites, I think, the top 29 sites with buffers with an estimated 10,000 to 113,000 people living within that area. So it's a ranking, if you will. It's a ranking of the number of people living within these buffers within 5 kilometers of our current or past mining operation. And what is striking is that, first, this exercise allows you to sum the total population potentially exposed, and that number is 1.6 million. And it also shows you that it turns out that these 29 buffers with the most, with the highest populations, they actually cover two-thirds on their own of the total population exposed. And then most of the rest contains between 1,000 and 10,000 people in each buffer. And so from that point of view, the problem looks large, 1.6 million, but perhaps also manageable if people, if the measurement of lead in soil, especially in areas where children play, could be measured fairly systematically within these buffers. So I'll show you one example, the worst case that we visited. This is the mining town in the Andes of Cerro de Pasco. It's actually buffer number, rank number 2 in terms of population exposed. And on the picture, you see this enormous pit that has been growing and continues to grow, and there are plans to make it even larger. And it's been eating into the town, essentially, and the people in the town have been moving away. But you can see in the picture to the right here that there are still many people living in the area. And the picture and the person is one of our students who is a master's student in public health, who was working with us on this project, Carolina Bravo. And she's holding a handheld X-ray fluorescence analyzer that is very convenient to measure lead in surface soil within a few seconds. It's not a cheap instrument. It's depending on the model, it's between $20,000 and $40,000 for one unit. But it works very well. And the type of map that you can make here is shown to the lower side. I've classified the measurements according to the lead level. So green would be the areas that that still meet the EPA limit for areas where people play. So here in the southeastern part of the town, for instance. Yellow is in that intermediate zone, a lot of yellow in Cerro de Pasco, and of course a lot of much higher levels, up to close to where the ore is being concentrated today. This black here is more than 10,000, as I recall, it was 12,000 ppm. And these results are consistent with results based on laboratory measurements that were carried out a couple of years before our visit by CDT. You can see the pits on this map here. One of the tailings, the piles of tailings here, and then there's another one to the outside the map to the southwest. The CDC report also included blood lead measurements for children, And two-thirds, and there were some remarkable features, is that the children living in the most affected area, they also had frequently blood lead levels above 10 microgram per deciliter. And the mothers of these children typically did not have very similarly high levels, and it wasn't as geographically tied to the contamination of the soil, providing an indication that it really is the children's behavior, the putting of the soil in their mouth, is what was causing a lot of the exposure. So why would a field kit be good enough? I mentioned the price of the XRF analyzer, and I think it has to do with dynamic range, really. If you plot the same data on a histogram with a number of measurements as the y-axis across the regional concentrations, you can see that the concentrations measured essentially span a 30-fold range relative to the EPA 400 ppm level. And if that's the situation, and this is going to apply to arsenic as well, then you don't really care if you measure, if your percentage is 10% or even 50%. You're trying to classify the environment in a way that allows people to take action. And I think laboratory measurements, if you only do that, are actually detrimental to a solution because they obviously take more effort and are more expensive to produce and logistically more complicated. So that is our main motivation right now for trying to come up with a kit that allows you to get a good idea of which parts of the town, like this one, and there are many more throughout the Andes, because mining has been taking place for so long, what sort of simple kits could you allow to essentially maybe even classify the soil in two or four or four categories? That would already be very useful. So another example of spatial distribution and incredible spatial variability is on the way to the Andes from the capital of Peru, from Lima, is a railroad, and that railroad has been used for decades to transport the ore to the coast. And here you see one of these carloads, and it's a point where the locomotive is rotated. Essentially, it has to pull the cars, and so the trains stand there for some time. And one thing I'd like you to notice is this whitish powder here. It turns out that material contains well over 10,000 ppm lead again. And so it is somehow, even though these train cars, these are covered, this kind of dust is coming off them. And this little girl here walking to school, I was there myself, Sheila Zaya Craigie, a former master's student, actually visited this site. And she was struck by how many people were unaware of what was happening. And here you see the turning point on the map. And you can see that if the local authorities knew this in a specific sense rather than in a vague sense that, yes, we know that the area is contaminated, then some action could be taken and the problem, the impact of the problem could be very much reduced at, I think, what is probably a relatively modest cost. It means digging up this area rather than thinking you have to dig up the whole area or the whole area along the railroad track. Things aren't always so bad, including in Peru. I switched to the buffer rank number 15 in terms of population within 5 kilometers. And this is a fairly a modern zinc mine, just a couple of decades old, and seems to be exploited in a much more responsible way. There are no people living very nearby. This is the tailings pond here on the map. This is a 2 kilometer bar. So the closest town is about 10 kilometers away. And when we measured the lead with the XRF walking around here, we actually had trouble finding any indication that there was much contamination. So the highest levels we found were here, essentially downwind from this concentration plant, which did produce some dust. And those levels were on the order of 1,300 ppm. There were some orange trees, mandarin trees growing there. And in the most contaminated area, those didn't look as very happy. But other than that, there was really very little indication of a major environmental impact. So local measurements don't always bring bad news. They can bring good news, but most importantly, they can distinguish the affected areas from the ones that are not. A very large smelter was built fairly recently rather close to Lima in Cajamarquilla, and here's a photo of it. I have to keep looking for my arrow. This is a photo of it with a pond here. This is an aerial view of the same. You can see the shape of the pond here matches that. And Zaya went around with the XRF unit. I think at that time my colleague Vladimir Gil from Peru was also accompanying her. And here again, there was an impact measured here, a few data points, but by and large, the whole area, including the inhabited area, doesn't seem to be affected in any significant way by the activity. So this is the value of this type of information. And it may even, Peru is known for the fact that a lot of communities are actually opposing the development of new mines because they're worried about situations like Cerro de Pasco. And one of the reasons we've been working on this project is that we feel that if the community could produce its own data rather than having to trust the company necessarily, maybe that could bring some reconciliation as well, because blocking mining altogether is not good for the economic growth of the country. And so that is one of our motivations there. So where are we in terms of the field kits? Well, we're not quite there yet, I will confess. There was actually for a while, you could buy on the web this kit here advertised on the lower right for about $56. I forget how many samples you can analyze with that. Oh, it was a half dozen. And we tried it on the soil that we brought back from Peru. And it turns out that it didn't work, in large part because the pH control was too poor. And so often the soil had quite a bit of calcium carbonate, and the pH just wasn't too low enough to release the lead from the soil. The principle, although I think it's somewhat proprietary, I don't think it's hard to guess that it has to do with a paper that goes back to 1942, where it was noted that the organic compound sodium rhodizinate actually responds to a lot of these heavy metals, including lead, at a fairly low pH. And this has been used also for the lead testing in paint, which I do think is much more reliable. The soil matrix is harder to analyze in such a way with an application. So we've been going back and try to modify that slightly. So one thing we've done is we've been using a half molar sodium citrate solution at pH 2 to extract the lead from a series of Peru samples. And use a saturated sodium rhodizinate to analyze it just visually. And so we created our own scale. You see here these four drops. And if you look at how much lead is extracted, we measure that in the extract with a handheld XRF and X-ray fluorescence analyzer. If you look at that, the match is not perfect, but you can see that by and large, the samples that met the 400 ppm level, they were either in category 1 or 2, and by and large, the samples that had more than 1200 ppm were in categories 3 and 4, with a few sort of in between. So it looks like this simple approach could already allow you to distinguish the most contaminated soils, like here, where you really don't want children to be playing, from the others, which are ranging from moderately to non-contaminated in the system. We're now also, in order to make a closer connection to what is, I should point out one thing first. So the way this extractable lead was defined is essentially extracted in this sodium citrate solution at a pH of about 2. That is not necessarily what is bioavailable or bioaccessible. And so we're now trying to apply this to a more standard method, the Drexler and Bratton method that was published in 2007, which is based on a glycine leach at pH 1.5 for just an hour. And so I have a a new student, Francisca Landes, who is working on that and applying it to the Peru soil. And soil from actually a half dozen countries we've been receiving through the Blacksmith Institute, where we know where they come from. We can measure the lead content by XRF. We know the type of activity. Is it smelting? Is it battery recycling? Is it mining? And we try to come up with a kit that is going to be fairly simple to use, inexpensive, and reliable. So that's it in terms of the as far as the lead story is concerned. And I'm going to switch to a different topic: arsenic exposure from drinking untreated groundwater from tube wells in South and Southeast Asia. Oops, for some reason my thing jumped ahead. Sorry. But you'll see that there are some similarities. So just to give you some background, the population affected by this problem is mind-boggling. If you look at the areas in South and Southeast Asia that are low-lying, essentially sedimentary environment, floodplains, deltaic environments, and a number of people, including Peter Ravenscroft, whose map I've adapted here, have made a prediction based on geology and hydrology and climate, if you will, of where arsenic could be an issue. And there are a couple of mechanisms that are included here, one that is operating under oxic conditions, but mostly it is a reductive dissolution process of iron oxides, which releases the arsenic to groundwater. And you see these areas mapped here that are a potential problem. Many of these problem areas have been confirmed. Others have not. For instance, the map shows that Thailand would be an issue, but that turns out not to be the case, and people are still trying to understand exactly why that is. But the population living within these colored areas is on the order of 100 million. It's more than 100 million people exposed to more than 10 micrograms per liter of arsenic in their drinking water on a daily chronic basis. The map, by the way, I should point out, the shading within the colored areas doesn't reflect so much the levels of arsenic as the population density. So it is an indication of severity, but from a population density point of view. And the three areas I'm going to focus on that I have some data, recently collected data from, hello? Oh, I thought I heard someone. From Bangladesh here, clearly the most affected country with 50 million people drinking water they shouldn't be drinking. The state of Bihar in India, and Lower Irrawaddy River in Myanmar or Burma. I'm going to show you some spatial distributions for those three systems. And those are the maps made in Google Earth. Not all of them are equally easy to look at. But essentially what I'm using here is a color coding based on the arsenic level, based on field kit testing, by the way. Light blue means the circles mean the wells meet the WHO guideline. Green means there is between 10 and 50 microgram per liter arsenic, and red exceeds 50 microgram per liter. And that can be as much as 1,000 microgram per liter, in other words, 100 times the WHO guideline. And as in the case of lead, what I think is striking from these maps, and you can see individual villages, the wells are concentrated in the villages. They're not in the fields, which are used for growing rice primarily. They are in this portion of a village. Here's another village in Bangladesh. I'm sorry, the background's a bit dark. And this is a village in the in Myanmar with a lower population density and a lower density of wells. But what you see is essentially one of our first findings when we started working in Bangladesh with Joe Graziano and Habib Hassan from Columbia School of Public Health at the time. What was really striking is the spatial variability. And so we calculated that within our area where we had tested several thousand wells, 50% of the people were drinking water from wells they shouldn't be drinking from. They contain more than 50 microgram per liter. We used the national standard at the time. We no longer do that now. And but if you make a very simple ArcVue or ArcGIS calculation, you actually also discover that 90% of the people live within 100 meters of a well that does meet the WHO guideline. And so the next logical step then becomes, you know, how can you get people to share the subset of wells that are safe? There's more information in terms of mitigation. So not only, so here I've picked two other villages where we spend quite a bit of time. This is Edbardi village in Arahazaupazila. It's about 15 kilometers from east of Dhaka, the capital city. And this is another village just a kilometer to the north of that first village. And most people know the depth of their well because they paid for every section of PVC pipe that went into its construction. And what is striking is that if you then plot this, the field kit data, and combine that with depth information for a particular village. So this axis here, the horizontal axis, just longitude. So these two safe samples correspond to these two ones here. You realize that the people who have been installing wells that are up to, say, 100 feet, they have a 50 chance of reaching water that is high or low in arsenic. But the people that invest just a little bit more, down to 200 feet, you can see that by and large, they will always reach an aquifer that is low in arsenic. So this is really valuable information if it could be provided and understood locally. And we're working on that. We've been working on that for many years. The government hasn't always been cooperative in Bangladesh, and it's still a struggle, but we think that this is the way to go. You will also notice that in the other village, which is just a kilometer away, if you install at 200 feet, you still don't have a very good chance of reaching good water. And so here the recommendation, you're tailored to that specific village, this is a 1 kilometer bar here, you'd have to go to at least 500 feet to make sure you get safe water from an arsenic point of view. So an example of the value of combining local field kit data with depth information and mapping that in a simple way. It's still true today, when we mention the arsenic problem in Southeast Asia, the first thought that comes to people's mind is why don't you treat the water? You know, we know arsenic has a strong affinity for iron oxides. Iron oxide-based media really absorb arsenic from water. And that is correct. The fact remains that the impact of any form of arsenic removal in Bangladesh and South Asia, whether it's at the community level or at the household level, these are typically privately installed wells, it's been not negligible, but it's been really small. So I'm showing you here on a pie diagram that 6-7 years ago, we estimated how many people were actually switching, and we had a couple of different sources for that. And we thought that of the people who were exposed in Bangladesh, maybe a third had switched to a neighbor's well. And then these deep tube wells, I showed you an example of a well of a village where you could go down just to 200 feet and reach this systematically low arsenic aquifer. These have clearly had the biggest impact. And all the other mitigation methods combined, including arsenic removal, the little black pie here, have had a much smaller in a second, and so they don't know the status of their well. But the deep tube well pie has probably increased, or at least double that size. The government has by now has installed in the order of 200,000 deep tube wells throughout the country. This information point of view here, let's focus on the central area where we spent most of our time. This is that one village in Bangladesh. So we tested the area in 2000-2001. Those were laboratory measurements. The government had a big blanket testing program in 2003 using field kits. And we went back, we just completed a large survey of 50,000 wells in our area, including in this village. And the striking result, it has to be updated, but the result is that after our testing 13 years ago, after the government testing 2003, still well over half the wells, the status was unknown. And that proportion is even greater in Myanmar, as you can see, and even greater, as hardly any testing has taken place in the Indian state of Bihar. And the main reason for this is clear. If you look at the histogram of the number of wells installed in various time periods, and I'm showing that in 5-year intervals for our particular study area, and you can see that the status was known, so red of green, for the wells installed up to, you know, 2000, 2001, and then the number of wells with the unknown status shown in yellow clearly picked up, and so the wells installed, you know, in most recently, the status of hardly any of those is known. So what is happening is that there's enormous amount of turnover in the stock of these private wells, either because they fail after some time, the filter maybe clogs, or the PVC pipe collapses, but often also because people would like to move it. Let's make it closer to, let's put it closer to the kitchen where it's convenient, or closer to a latrine. And so many of the wells that we tested back in 2000 are just no longer there. And that means field kit testing should continue, and not just in, you know, occasional blanket testing campaigns. Just to give you an idea, remind you why field kit testing is helpful in this case, this is a histogram of the range of exposures based on water. So the WHO guideline here, it's this one single blue bar. This is a map of our entire study area with, you know, spatial variability and a range of scales. So here instead, this is a 2 kilometer bar here. And you can see that here, the full range of concentration, it's actually 100-fold, as I pointed out. And so if we had a kit that does a good job distinguishing the light blue from the green from the red wells, that is perfectly, that would already make a big difference. And occasionally I still have discussions with analytical chemists, I consider myself an analytical chemist, and they get all excited about being able to distinguish, 45 from 55 microgram per liter. But I think it's a red herring to a large extent. It's not what is needed to address this particular problem. So this is how the kit that we've been using, which works rather well. It costs about, if you buy it in bulk, it's about $90 for a kit for 300 tests. It's called the ITS EconoQuick test kit. We trained 10 women, local women, villagers with primary school education to use these kits and enter the data in a handheld GPS. This is an older model by now, and I'm sure Andy would say we should do this with a smartphone by now, and he's right, and people are using smartphones in Bangladesh as well. This is a typical well, cast iron pump here, one of our testers, and these are then the placards that we post depending on the results. So the principles go back to 1879, the other kit was 1942, here we go even back further in time, and essentially all the kits for arsenic and water are based on this generation of arsine upon addition of zinc to an acidified sample. And it's captured on this arsine is captured on the mercury bromide strip, and it changes color across a range of browns here. And by putting the strip, below this strip in the hole here, this calibration scale, you get the readings. And so these two readings correspond to WHO guideline, and this is to the local national standard and above that. And we've done some quality control, of course. We've compared that, and the vast majority of our results are correct. And if anything, the kit overestimates the exposure slightly, which is the direction you want any sort of error to go if it has to go in a direction. So that's it for that part of the presentation. I'm now going to try to cover the biggest struggle, I think, is I've talked about chemistry, spatial variability, and the challenge we're still facing is how do you get people to make these measurements, either themselves or have someone with some training make these measurements. And that's where the behavioral and economic components probably play a role. Starting from the Bangladesh story, we've just finished testing about 50,000 wells using the team of these 10 women. It took them 18 months to do that. They were doing on average about 12 wells a day. And every week they would meet with our supervisor and would download the data onto his laptop. He would plot it on Google Earth. He could really track, they were instructed to go from one village to the other and not jump all over the place. And he could really track their progress that way. When you add up all the cost of the testing, including the labor of the people locally, it amounted to $2.40 per test. What this pie diagram shows is that a small part of that actually is the test kit. That's about 30 cents. or, you know, the amortized GPS unit, some field supplies. Salaries is, you know, both the supervision and the village health workers. That was a significant portion of the pie. But the single most expensive part, I'll go back a slide, was making these metal placards. We have not found a way of reducing that cost to below $1 each. It has to be stainless steel, otherwise it rusts, especially in that very humid climate. It has to be printed, it has to have a different message. Blanket testing campaign ended in 2003, most of the wells had been painted, you know, either green or red. But as you can see from the material here, this cast iron, that's not the best material to have your paint stick to. And in fact, for most of these wells, the paint was no longer visible within a year of the testing. And families, we have evidence, you know, that families households do remember the results of the testing, but clearly their neighbors don't know. And if they'd like to ask, you know, whether they could use a neighbor's well, without the, you know, the clear evidence of the test results, it's hard to implement that. This also raises some privacy issues, of course, and we're still not quite sure how to deal with that. Right now, some people remove the red placards because they think they're difficult to implement in a country like the U.S., and so we're really thinking hard about the trade-offs that we're facing in Bangladesh. Not making the results known to the households is clearly a mistake. To what extent to let them be known to neighbors is something we're still struggling with. So the cost is $240 per test. It's interesting to compare this with the cost of a well. A well, a 100-foot well, they cost about $100 to install. So compared to the cost of installing the well, you might say, well, of course, people should be testing their well. They're spending a lot more on the well itself. This has been rather difficult to actually carry out, and I'll go through an intervention in a minute. It's also interesting to use the cost of installing these wells, which is, as I said, between $100 or $300 per well. It means that in Bangladesh only, where there are 10 million wells, that means the population households privately has spent over $1 billion. And this is in a country that is one of the poorest countries in the world, of course. So clearly valuing the fact that at least the groundwater is typically much less contaminated from the microbial point of view, microbial pathogens, than any surface water that they have access to in these villages. So we decided that maybe one sort of semi-market approach would do it. We knew that $2.40 was going to be too much for a largely poor country. And so what we did is that we proposed in Bihar, this particular study, in 26 villages, we proposed prices for the testing ranging between $0.20 and $1. And we just tried to see, you know, what proportion of people in these villages, these 26 villages, were willing to buy the test. In order to sort of encourage them, we would go in the villages first, and we had some local students hired, and they would go around with maps producing Google Earth, making the point that from a neighboring village, typically, making the point that the distribution of there are high arsenic wells, but there are also low arsenic wells. And so if you and your neighbors test your wells, you might have a solution. This, of course, came along with a message about the health risks, both for infants and adults of continued exposure to arsenic. Well, so there was some information campaign, a public health education campaign, and this essentially were the results. At the lowest price of $0.20, we were able to sell about 90% of the households approached bought the test on average, a bit less than that. And this declined as a function of price, not too surprising. But even at about a dollar, it was still about 50%. And so this was an interesting finding because this whole idea that households should be willing to prevent for preventive health care, it's actually quite controversial now in development economic circles. Not my specialty, obviously, but there has long been this notion that people should pay for their health care. But when careful studies, randomized controlled trials, are carried out with respect to, say, bed purchasing bed nets to protect against malaria, or deworming pills for children in schools, or products to disinfect water, some chlorine-based products. It turns out that the demand at any price, I mean, it really at any price, it really declines very, very fast. And so my impression from this, at least, is that yes, we have a decline in demand with price, but it's maybe not as steep as some of these other health-related products that people have been encouraging distribution of. I mean, the reason, that's the point I wanted to make. The other point I wanted to make is that it's interesting to see that if we were to say, well, let's charge 10 to 20 rupees, so between 20 and 40 cents, it will get 80% uptake. That's still clearly a minor fraction of the actual cost of the testing, the 240. And so the idea of charging the households is not so much to try to recover a large portion of the total cost, which is clearly not impossible and not possible in the current situation, but it is to create potentially an incentive for someone to go out and make a living from testing wells. And so that's what we're working on now. We are trying to, we have several trials that we are trying to seek funding for, where we, rather than actually asking the money from the households, we will pay in proportion to the number of wells tested, but we will pay that from some central pot of money. And we think that the government should do that eventually. If you go through the calculations of the lives lost and all that, it turns out that a rational government should be doing that. And so we're trying to work in that direction right now. From the payment side, keeping the portion of it that is proportional to the amount of work produced, but probably charging it essentially centrally rather than having the households pay for it. I think without GPS technology, this would be impossible to do because the temptation to just create fake reports of tests would be too large. Thanks to GPS technology and mobile phones, it's now fairly easy for a supervisor to go to a site and retest the well, or even without going to a site, call the person whose mobile phone number has been registered on the smartphone and verify that indeed a test has been carried out and that the results were consistent. So that's the end of the story I had to present. Some other crazy ideas we're thinking about. One of them is, when we test the wells, you don't always get the response you hope for. People don't always switch. On average, about 50% of them do, and we try to motivate them. In other health-related fields, we know people continue to smoke as well, even though they know it's in most cases it's not good for them. So one thing we're trying to do is come up with a personal measure of exposure, and so I have another student who is working on modifying this arsine-based test kit to test urine. Urine is a good measure of exposure as far as arsenic is concerned, and we start from the idea that if a mother sees a brown strip coming from the urine of her own child and compares it to the strip that's produced by a neighbor's child who's drinking from a good well, and that's a white strip, we're hoping that will be another way of encouraging households to take action. In a completely different field, there have been a few papers about the use of hair and atomic fluorescence in a sort of portable unit to try to discourage artisanal miners from exposing themselves to high levels of mercury. And one of my colleagues at University of Tennessee has had this idea that even bacterial contamination for viruses in particular in drinking water could be used with a simple kit as well. The fact remains, I think, that for these types of approaches to really have the impact they should, is that someone needs to make a living from this type of testing, and that's clearly an area where we need to work on. I'll conclude by pointing out that all this work really, for me as a geochemist, this notion of the spatial variability, how local measurements are important. This I never would have reached this point without the interactions with my colleagues at the School of Public Health, and without the support that we now have had from the Superfund research program from more than 13 years by now in Bangladesh. As well, we have also several projects going on in the U.S. and and we're very thankful for having been able to do this work over time. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Lex. That was quite a good overview of two different studies that you're doing, and very pertinent to how you can use GIS and have a very practical angle of it, which is the test kits. We're going to have some time for questions, so like we did last time, I'd like to go to the phone lines first, and I believe we have things up and running now at this point, so that if you would like to ask a question on the phone line, all you need to do is hit star and six, then state your name and organization and ask your question. And of course, you're also welcome to ask questions on the right question and answer panel. And when you do that, I will be able to read those online if you're feeling shy. Didn't sound like we had any questions on the phone line, so I'll just read questions that did come in. So Lex, David James asks, he says he likes the simple color metric lead extraction and reaction test. Are there any plans to test this in the field for presence or absence or low, medium, or high soil concentrations?
So the tests that I went back to the slide with our sort of first round of tests, so those were not carried out in the field, and you know, a one-day extraction would be a little cumbersome, so that's why we hope the one-hour extraction will be easier to implement. The plan is absolutely to have this, you know, be possible in the field eventually. The little soil kit that's you know, that used to be available commercially, I'm not exactly sure why it was withdrawn, but it certainly didn't work in our case. But you see, these are the types of things you need. You need some scintillation vials, some pipettas, maybe a little scooper, and so we very much hope to package this in a way that maybe would, yes, classify the soil in three levels. I think that sort of a like a traffic light, a green, orange, and red. I think that would be just the way we're doing it now for the arsenic in Bangladesh as well.
Great. So I had a question, too, while we're talking about the lead. There were a few questions about your arsenic study, but I did have a couple questions about lead, if you would entertain them for me.
Sure.
So it sounded like some of the interference you were getting with the lead testing kits was based on the pH, and I just wondered, is there a way to pre-treat a sample with some sort of buffer, or is that an additional interference, or maybe that is the solution you were proposing?
Yeah, no, so you know, using the sodium citrate is a step in that direction.
Okay.
My impression is that probably the kit will have to include a pH strip of
okay.
some sort, you know, and so maybe then you can add more of the extractant solution or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So it would almost be a two-step kit where you first figure out what your pH is, and then you might have a different kind of formula for the second part of the kit based on...
Yeah, I mean, we'd rather have it as simple as possible, but
right.
certainly in these mining deposits where you can have a lot of calcium carbonate, I think that's probably going to be important. Yeah.
Okay. Mary Ballou asks, can you get down to 100 parts per million with the colorimetric test? I believe this popped up when we were talking about lead.
Yeah, and given the units, I think it refers to that.
Okay.
I don't know whether we're going to be able to do that. Certainly, you know, this preliminary test shows that it wasn't great. Essentially, we were, you know, shifting between if you use this as the 100, and this was actually the extractable lead, so it wasn't even the total lead. If I had shown you this for total lead in the soil, not all of it is extractable or bioavailable, it would have even shown more scatter than this particular plot does. So. I can see why you'd want to be able to, you know, detect above and below the 100 ppm threshold, but the most urgent need right now is, you know, around the 1,000 threshold, and so I think we'll focus on that. Although I see why your point and why eventually you'd like it to become more sensitive.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking extractable lead. Does that mean that's bioavailable, or is that yet something different?
Well, we Our student Francisca has just actually been re-extracting some of these samples by both methods, both the sodium citrate and the glycine-based method, which has been compared with some swine studies, I understand, and so is seen as a reasonable proxy. I suspect that a lot of what is not extracted either in the sodium citrate or the glycine is probably not bioavailable either, but we need to quantify that, of course.
Another question that came from David James, could chelation help with extraction of lead from the soil?
So, the citrate is a chelator of the lead ion, the cation, as far as I understand. I hadn't thought what you're suggesting, which is maybe using the chelating used for treat children as a way of extracting the soil. I thought of that, which I'll explore that. And it's actually also a coincidence that, you know, my main colleague in the Maimon School of Public Health, Joe Graziano, was the one who introduced and developed the most widely used chelating therapy for exposed children exposed to lead right now. So I'll definitely mention it to him.
Great. Sounds like a good thing to follow up on. Jimmy Spiro submits this question regarding the sodium rosidonite colorimetric test. How do you adjust for interference by other metals that also cause a color change?
That's a very good question. In fact, we had some cases where we thought, well, we don't see much lead here, but what else could be there? And it turned out that there was quite a bit of zinc. And when you look at that little table in the 1942 paper, you see that the zinc is released as well. Now, often the zinc co-occurs, you know, with silver and with lead. It's not always the case. And So you're right, and zinc is not particularly toxic either. So you could have some warnings that in the end don't reflect the lead, or at least the lead that can be extracted. The zinc is also often more easy to extract than the lead from a soil sample. So it's not going to be a perfect kit. It's going to be a way maybe of saying, well, if you have this problem based on the lead kit, then you should send your sample to City Hall, and let's hope City Hall, at least some environmental department, has a handheld XRF, and then the sample can be analyzed. So I see it as a screening tool, but it has its limitations, and yes, and this person is right to point this out.
Great. Walter, a number of questions came in about the Bangladeshi arsenic study, so why don't we move ahead and focus on that. Clem Furlong asks if the wells are steel-cased.
So the wells are PVC. It's PVC. I think one of the reasons there has been this boom in well construction in the past decade or two is the availability of PVC. The drilling technique is really remarkable. It uses PVC again with just a GI pipe, a galvanized iron pipe at the end, and a hand as a check valve to essentially recirculate the sand that is being extracted from the hole that goes down. And so a team of 4 to 5 men can go down to 300 feet within a single day and install a PVC well. So it's a PVC screen, sort of slotted PVC, PVC sections, 20-foot sections glued together all the way to the top, and then the end part of it has maybe a 3-foot section of GI pipe and a concrete platform, and that's what the hand pump is mounted on. So it's somewhat more rigid at the top.
Okay.
That's how it's constructed.
Okay, and no perforations at depth?
The screen at the end. So the last piece of PVC is a screen, and that's how the water comes in.
Okay. Great. So, question about whether the. Again, this is from Furlong from University of Washington.
Right. So, as I recall, the form of arsenic in fish. It's an organic form, and I'm not quite sure it would react in the arsine medium.
Gotcha.
I can tell you that MMA and DMA don't respond to the field kit, to the arsine generation, and so we've tried to oxidize that, for instance, and we haven't succeeded. And so we are now essentially saying, well, even if the inorganic fraction of arsenic is known only within, say, a factor of 2 in a particular population, it still is useful to measure how much that is over two orders of magnitude because it could classify the range of exposure. Again, it's a tool to change behavior and not a tool for making precise measurements.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. David James asks, suggests, perhaps there would be some benefit to investing in development of alternative water treatment systems, especially on the deltas of the rivers, for example, the Ganges, where the deep wells might hit saline water.
Yeah, so I can I always go back to this pie diagram, and you know I'm afraid this hasn't changed. And so I've mentioned arsenic removal. If the participant was referring maybe to a treatment of surface water like Ganges water, I actually visited one of these plants without warning in about a year ago. And the plant was not running. I think it cost several million dollars to build. It was supposed to distribute the water to these villages, typical of the area. So on the day I visited, it was certainly not working. When I left the plant with an Indian colleague of mine, there were guards everywhere and people were saluting. But clearly, before they knew anyone was coming, there wasn't much activity. Not only that, even if you treat that water, so first by getting the sediment to drop out and then a chlorine treatment, aeration and chlorine treatment, there's still the problem of distributing it. These are very densely populated areas, 1,000 people per square kilometer, but it's still rural areas. And so very few of the pipe networks had been laid out from that plant to the villages. And the few that were sort of the pilot villages, we were told that that water was actually available only a few hours a day, and it was unreliable. So the system was not pressurized all the time, and as many of you know, if you don't keep your system under pressure, you will have recontamination with microbial pathogens of the water. So I see it as a solution for more urbanized settings with a considerable amount of infrastructure and maintenance. I hope this is what will happen in these areas in 10 years. But in the meantime, people need to drink some water that doesn't have the high arsenic levels.
Great. So a question came in, almost sociological-based, but whether you think that having paid testers may lead to corruption, as in false positives, whether that might be necessary for a tester to keep his or her job on an ongoing basis.
So the way we're thinking about enforcing sort of good measurement is basically by training a tester, giving a kit, so 300 tests. Certainly the beginning, have a random subsample, retested like 10%. And tell the person if there are more than X mismatches, then you don't get the second kit. And a kit is $90, so the person is not going to have access to that all that easily. And essentially decertify that person. I don't see. I have heard of testers hired by drillers being asked to falsify the results because the drillers didn't want the bad news to reach the household or the community they were installing well from. So All these possibilities are there, but that's where I think the technology is really going to make a difference. To some extent the mapping, but especially the quality control. I think what you want is the communities and the households to say, if this tester says this is the result, then I will believe it, and essentially the value of that job has to be higher than the bribe that a particular driller wants to pay the tester.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. It helps to be knowledgeable about the community then, certainly, doesn't it?
Well, we're still discovering, I can tell you that.
Yeah, but I know that your group at Columbia has invested, as you said, over a decade of work in that region. And made a big difference to a lot of people's lives. Let me see if there are any more questions, and I'm just going to open it up for not only questions for Lex, but also questions for our first speaker, Andy. Again, take your phone off mute by pressing *6, and you can state your name and ask your question. And I think if we don't hear from anybody, then we'll probably conclude the webinar. But we'll give just a brief minute, star 6, if you'd like to ask a question on the phone. Okay, it's awful quiet. why don't I read through some final announcements, and if anybody does have a final question, you can shoot it to us on the question and answer. I just wanted to make sure that you know that on the links page we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's webinar. This will stay with the webinar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. And we typically place these seminars on an archive within a soundtrack. So in the near future, I think probably in about a week from now, you should be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. So associated with the links page is an online feedback form. So it would be great if you could fill out to do these in the future. So please look out for our upcoming webinar series. I believe the next series will be about PCBs. I also have learned that the first session of this series will be rebroadcast on February 6, 2014. The registration information is available on the SRP and CLUIN websites. That talk featured work in Maine, as I recall, again, just arsenic testing in Maine. Oh, no, excuse me. It was Superfund site assessment and distance of schools from Superfund sites. So it's a way you can use GIS for that, as well as a case study in Puerto Rico looking at environmental exposures of groundwater, and again, using mapping to see the spatial resolution of that. So again, that webinar will be rebroadcast on February 6th. So we will send that information to anyone who registered the first time and possibly to anyone else who participated in that in this seminar series. So stay up to date with the latest SRP news and events by following the SRP Twitter feed, which is at SRP_NIEHS. So I will just give people one more chance to ask questions, and while we do so, let's see, there were a couple more questions online. David James asked, is there a need to expand the development of teams of testers in Bangladesh? He says, if so, the Asia Foundation, and he provides a website address. He says, the Asia Foundation has expertise in this area, having supported water testing training in Laos and Mongolia.
So thank you for this tip. No, we are very much, we keep writing proposals to try to get testers trained and paid in a way that will encourage them to do a good job. One thing that we're focusing on too now is that people don't share wells as much as we would like, and so we've come up with a scheme. We just sent out a proposal on that to USAID. Where we think we should give them, they should get a bonus if they manage to get an agreement between, say, 5 households to share whichever wells are safe within their set before the testing results are known. And we hope that this might overcome some of the cultural barriers. So thank you, and I will look up the Asia Foundation.
Yeah, that sounds like a great lead for you. And again, Jimmy Sparrow sends his congratulations. He says, Dr. Van Heen, thank you for the important work that you have been doing, reducing the exposures of people to toxics in poor countries. So I think we all share that sentiment, and thank you, Jimmy, for passing on that that nice comment. I want to thank both of our presenters for an excellent presentation and for having dedication to the work that you've been doing. Wish you luck, Andy, in getting your PhD, and Dr. Van Heen in the future that you have with training new students and coming up with new test kit ideas. So we want to thank you very much for the time preparing for the talks, and again to Jean Ballant, Justin Crane, and we had a few other people, Peter and, Peter Riddle was also helping us out today.
And so is Kevin as
and
well.
And Kevin O'Donovan in the background. So we really appreciate that. Hope everybody has a fantastic weekend. And that includes today's webinar. Thank you very much for your participation. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.